Alexandria is the second largest city in Egypt, and with a population of over 5 million people, the largest city on the Mediterranean. It was founded in 331 BC by Alexander the Great, which is where it gets its name, and who I already covered in a video which I'll link to in the description for those who want to see it. Alexandria grew rapidly to become an important center of the Hellenistic civilization and remained the capital of Ptolemaic Egypt and Roman and Byzantine Egypt for almost 1,000 years until the Muslim conquest of Egypt in 641 AD. The Hellenistic period covers Mediterranean history between the death of Alexander the Great in 323 BC and the emergence of the Roman Empire, which officially starts in 31 BC with the victory of Octavian over Cleopatra and Mark Antony, and the conquest of Ptolemaic Egypt the following year. The Ptolemaic Kingdom was named after one of Alexander the Great's Macedonian generals, whose genetic line became the Pharaohic line from around 305 BC until the death of Cleopatra in 30 BC. I also covered the meaning of the origins of the term Hellenes in a prior video, which I'll also link to in the description, so I won't cover that again now. While some people consider this period as a time of foreign colonization and rule over Egypt, which is located on the African continent, but in actuality, Egyptian demographics traditionally share affinities with the Mediterranean region stretching back the entire Holocene, rather than having anything to do with sub-Saharan Africa, which is separated from North Africa by a massive desert known as the Sahara. So while Cleopatra and her ancestors stem from Greek, or more accurately, Macedonian stock, which is located on the northern part of the Mediterranean, ancient Egyptian records speak to a common Mediterranean origin that predates the Ptolemaic dynasty. The Atlantean myth, as passed down via Plato, is an ancient Egyptian tale whose genesis occurred so far back in history that, according to the Egyptian priest of Sias, the classical Greeks could not even recollect it. The story states that both Sias, a city in Egypt, and Athens, the capital of Greece, were founded by the same patron goddess, Athena, or known to the Egyptians as Neith. It was said that she founded Athens in 9600 BC and Egypt in 8600 BC. The Greek historian Solon learned from the Egyptian priests around 600 BC that Athens was founded 9,000 years before their time, and according to them, Old Kingdom Egypt began 1,000 years after that, which would have been around 8600 BC. While many will be quick to point out that the story of Atlantis is just a myth that has yet to be proven or officially recognized in academia, what is real and proven is DNA, as well as the fossil record of North Africa, which stretches back tens of thousands of years into the Pleistocene, or Ice Age. Some 40,000 years ago, Cro-Magnon, the first people that had a skeleton, particularly the skull, that looked anatomically modern, entered Europe. Geneticists now show that a Cro-Magnon individual who lived in southern Italy 28,000 years ago was a modern European, genetically as well as anatomically. They conclude that the Neanderthal people who lived in Europe for nearly 300,000 years are not the ancestors of modern Europeans. So the ancestors of modern Europeans are primarily Cro-Magnon, despite the recent scientific revelation that Europeans also share 2% of their genetic makeup with Neanderthals. They're essentially Cro-Magnon. Not only are there also Cro-Magnon-type settlements found in North Africa going back into the Ice Age, the oldest pre-dynastic mummified remains found in Egypt belong to a 5,400-year-old specimen now housed in the British Museum, nicknamed Ginger, because of his reddish blonde hair. Keep in mind that the remains were naturally mummified in the desert and did not undergo any embalming process, which many people like to claim is why many Egyptian mummies and pharaohs are blonde and red-headed. But Ginger, the oldest mummified remains found in Egypt, was not treated with any embalming chemicals or did not undergo any unnatural processes. That said, forensic Egyptologists have proven that fair-haired Egyptian mummies were natural blondes, contrary to the popular non-scientific belief. Dr. Janet Davey from the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine decided to do her own experiments, which included microscopic analysis, and concluded that fair-haired Egyptian mummies were in fact natural blondes. Quote, "The general public and a lot of Egyptologists think that the ancient Egyptians had very dark brown or black hair, but this shows there were fair-haired Egyptians." Of course, this does not speak to the entire demographics of the region, as there are clearly depictions of various ethnicities in ancient Egypt, especially among the various slaves, which do in fact include depictions of sub-Saharan African phenotypes. But among the pharaohs and nobility, one can look beyond the blonde and red hair, which is common among the ruling class, and inspect the facial bone structure, the cheekbones, the high nose bridge, and see that the pre-Ptolemaic dynasties mummies shared genetic affinities with other European populations, such as the case with Ramesses the Great, who had a very prominent nose, as you can see here, despite the fact that red henna was applied to his hair when he was mummified at 90 years old. Ramesses the Great was the third pharaoh of the 19th dynasty of Egypt, often regarded as the most powerful pharaoh of the New Kingdom. Professor P. F. Ciseldi, with a research team behind him, studied some hairs which were removed from the mummy of Ramesses II's scalp. Ramesses was 90 years old when he died, and his hair had turned white. Ciseldi determined that the reddish-yellow color of the mummy's hair had been brought about by its being dyed with dilute henna solution. However, traces of the hair's original color in his youth remained in the roots, even into advanced old age. Microscopic examination proved that the hair's roots contained traces of natural red pigment, and that therefore, during his youth, Ramesses the Great had been red-haired. It was also concluded that red pigments did not result from the hair somehow fading or otherwise altering post-mortem, but did indeed represent Ramesses' natural hair color. While there are many examples of natural blonde and red-headed mummies from all dynasties of ancient Egypt, especially the first and oldest ones, not to mention the many Egyptian statues that depict their pharaohs and nobility with blue eyes, most people are still unaware of the extensive genetic testing being conducted on dozens of mummies, many over 3,000 years old, which conclude that the ancient Egyptian mummies, quote, "closest kin were ancient farmers from a region that includes present-day Israel and Jordan. Modern Egyptians, by contrast, have inherited more of their DNA from Central Africans." Both types of genomic material showed that ancient Egyptians shared little DNA with modern sub-Saharan Africans. Instead, their closest relatives were people living during the Neolithic and Bronze Ages in the area known as the Levant. Strikingly, the mummies were more closely related to ancient Europeans and Anatolians than to modern Egyptians. The researchers say that there was probably a pulse of sub-Saharan African DNA into Egypt roughly 700 years ago. The mixing of ancient Egyptians and Africans from further south means that modern Egyptians can trace 8% more of their ancestry to sub-Saharan Africans than can the mummies. So according to the mythological, archaeological, and genetic data, the idea that Egypt was colonized by Europeans or people from the Mediterranean or Anatolia in relatively modern times, starting with Alexander the Great, is not quite correct. In actuality, the further back one goes into ancient Egyptian history, the more fair-haired, light-skinned, and light-eyed the demographics are, including pre-dynastic times. That means before there were pyramids or pharaohs. And it's only in recent times, in the post-Roman era, through things like the Muslim slave trade, that sub-Saharan African genetics have been infused into the North African population. An article published in 2017 in the journal Nature Communication states that, quote, "Until now, the study of Egypt's population history has been largely based on literary and archaeological sources and inferences drawn from genetic diversity in present-day Egyptians. Our analysis reveals that ancient Egyptians shared more ancestry with Near Easterners than present-day Egyptians, who received additional sub-Saharan admixture in more recent times. By directly studying ancient DNA from ancient Egyptians, we can test previous hypotheses drawn from analyzing modern Egyptian DNA, such as recent admixture from populations with sub-Saharan and non-African ancestries attributed to trans-Saharan slave trade and the Islamic expansion, respectively. We found the ancient Egyptian samples falling distinct from modern Egyptians and closer towards Near Eastern and European samples. In contrast, modern Egyptians are shifted towards sub-Saharan African populations. We find that ancient Egyptians are most closely related to Neolithic and Bronze Age samples in the Levant, as well as to Neolithic Anatolian and European populations. When comparing this pattern with modern Egyptians, we find that the ancient Egyptians are more closely related to all modern and ancient European populations that we tested, likely due to the additional African component in the modern populations." So rather than thinking of Alexander the Great as a foreign colonizer, or even the Hyksos dynasty as foreign rulers from Anatolia, it is more accurate to think of them, genetically and culturally speaking, as part of one Caucasian phenotype that dominated the ancient Mediterranean during the entire Holocene. And by Mediterranean, I mean all of North Africa, from Morocco to Egypt, as well as Ethiopia, which used to have a different ethnic nobility in ancient times. All of Southern Europe, and the entire Middle East, including the Levant, as well as Anatolia and territories along the Silk Road going into North India, Iran, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Mongolia, and Western China. While I understand that this is a controversial statement to make, I have no problem making it because I know that it's academically accurate and in alignment with objective scientific reality. It only becomes controversial to the degree that one has been indoctrinated into politically motivated propaganda. Otherwise, it's not controversial at all. What should be controversial instead is the mainstream anthropologists that keep insisting that we'll one day find a missing link to validate obsolete fairy tales such as the Out of Africa theory. While there have already been several hoaxes and frauds, such as Nebraska Man, which was announced as a missing link between ape and man, but turned out to be a tooth of a wild pig, or the Piltdown Man, which stood in the British Museum for almost 50 years during the first half of the 20th century until it was discovered that it was a baboon's jaw that was bleached and glued onto a human skull. Now, just last week, it turns out that a hominin specimen touted as humanity's earliest ancestor was not a hominin and thus was not the earliest known human ancestor. In a paper published in Journal of Human Evolution, a team of researchers from France have found evidence that the Sahelanthropus chadensis, which mainstream anthropologists claimed walked upright between 6.8 and 7.2 million years ago, which is twice as long ago as the famous Lucy, dated to about 3.2 million years ago, actually did not walk upright and thus was not a hominin, but instead an ape ancestor that walked on all fours like gorillas and other great apes. So it was not a hominin and was therefore not an early human ancestor. So while mainstream anthropology, once again, bites the dust, modern genomics seems to validate the ancient Egyptian, Greek, Hindu, and other mythologies, including the Bible, that all speak to a hybridization that took place in antiquity as a more viable explanation for how humanity came to be. Stories about gods or sons of God mating or interbreeding with mortals and having offspring which then repopulate the earth following times of periodic global cataclysm.
In the distant past, the Atlanteans, the fourth root race of creation, had split into pure and bestial species. After many thousands of years, the pure race, the Aryan godmen of the fifth root race, had interbred with the beasts. The result was catastrophic decline and the near loss of the Aryan psychic powers.
The term root race was coined by Helena Blavatsky in her book The Secret Doctrine, published in 1888. In it, she describes various epochs of time, or ages, similar to the ages of man of the ancient Greeks described by Hesiod, or the five suns described by the Maya civilization, where each age ends in some sort of cataclysm, and the survivors repopulate the earth and reestablish civilization. We also have these cyclical ages in Hindu philosophy called yugas, and in the Bible we have a story of Noah and the Great Flood, with his offspring surviving on a boat. And of course, there's the Egyptian story of Atlantis, which was passed down to Plato via Solon. So it's a common universal theme. And in the context of Blavatsky's work, the Atlanteans were the fourth root race, and the Aryans were the fifth root race. To put it in an anthropological term, Cro-Magnon would be the Atlanteans, as they were the first fully modern, anatomically correct human, meaning they had a larger cranial capacity than today's average. And it wasn't just about size of the skull, it was also the shape, as Neanderthal also had a high cubic centimeter cranial volume, but it was shaped differently, it was elongated. Only Cro-Magnon had a round skull, like we have, with a forehead and a chin, like we have, with no brow ridge or no big bulging, protruding eyebrow bone. And Cro-Magnon had an advanced toolkit and everything we attribute to advanced modern human. The fifth root race she called Aryan, and that would mean all of present-day humanity to various degrees, as we're all also mixed with other archaic hominins. Archaic means old or primitive, and to an anthropologist, that includes everything except Cro-Magnon. So Neanderthal, Denisovan, Homo erectus, and anything else you've heard of would all be considered archaic. And we're all mixed with these various species, but we're also all descended from Cro-Magnon, which during the Ice Age, in mythology, Blavatsky considered the Atlantean root race, and during the Holocene, she labeled the fifth or Aryan root race. According to Manetho, an Egyptian historian and priest who lived during the 3rd century BC, the total number of years covered by the Egyptian kings list equals roughly 36,000 years, which matches the fossil record for the era of Cro-Magnon. And he goes on to say that the rule of the demigods immediately follows the reign of the gods. So it's interesting how mythology matches up with the fossil record. And to help drive this point home with DNA, here's a short excerpt from a talk given by Professor David Reich, a geneticist known for his research into the population genetics of ancient humans.
So what I and my colleagues were involved with developing was a set of tests where we were really trying to test whether Neanderthals interbred in some way with modern humans. And the way we did it was the following. There were multiple tests, and here is the simplest one, which is pretty easy to explain. So this is a cartoon of a chromosome, your DNA, which, as you know, is a 3 billion letter long, approximately, sequence of letters, A, C, T, or G, adenine, cytosine, thymine, or guanine, is packaged into 23 pairs of chromosomes. which are just packets of DNA that get passed down from father to child or mother to child. And this cartoon is a cartoon of a chromosome with this ball in the middle supposed to be the centromere, which is a structural element in the chromosomes, and these arms being the arms where the DNA is held. And so what we did is we lined up a chromosome from a European person and a sub-Saharan African person. This is a Nigerian individual. We looked at all the places we could detect where those two individuals were different. And then we looked which the Neanderthal had. Did the Neanderthal match the Nigerian person more or the European person more? And if it's true that we all come out of a common African population that separated earlier from the ancestors of Neanderthals, all people today should match Neanderthals exactly equally often, and that's, you can show this mathematically, but it also makes sense intuitively. And when we actually did that analysis and said, how often does the Neanderthal match the European or the Nigerian, it was about, we would expect it to be exactly equally often, but there was about a 2 to 4% significant excess matching to Europeans. So this was highly statistically significant. It wasn't just Europeans, it was also East Asians, and it was also New Guineans. It was all non-Africans, showed this pattern of excess matching compared to Nigerians, but not just Nigerians, to Central Africans, to East Africans, to Southern Africans. It was a general difference in non-Africans being more closely related to Neanderthals than are sub-Saharan Africans. This was one of several tests, but using this combination of tests, we were able to show unambiguously that Neanderthals interbred with modern humans, and in fact, the Neanderthal sequence we had was from an individual related within at most about 100,000 years to the population that interbred with actually us, or at least non-Africans today. We also were able to estimate how much Neanderthal ancestry there is into people today, and the way we did that is as follows. We took a non-African, and we saw how often they matched a Neanderthal relative to an African person, and then we replaced that with a second Neanderthal sequence we had data from, and we say how much of the way of toward a complete Neanderthal is a non-African person, and they were about 2% of the way, and that we can interpret that as evidence that non-Africans today have about 2% of their DNA derived from these archaic humans. East Asians, we now know, have actually significantly more Neanderthal DNA than do West Eurasians like Europeans, and there's actually, we know exactly why that is. I'm happy to talk about that as well. While we were finishing the Neanderthal project, there was a finger bone in a cave in Siberia, southern Siberia on the border of Mongolia and Kazakhstan and Russia, that was marked as a modern human by the Russian archaeologists who excavated it. But in fact, when it was sequenced by this laboratory in Germany, it was found to be neither a Neanderthal nor a modern human, but something else entirely. It was a finger bone of a little girl. This is the size of it. And it was almost, it was amazing that it was even identified as human. But once it was sequenced, it was clear it was like nothing that we had ever seen before. The individual was, here's several Neanderthals, was farther, more distant from Neanderthals than any that were from each other, but genetically was more similar to Neanderthals than they are to modern humans. So this is a very interesting observation, and meant we had discovered a third population of humans, and a second population of archaic humans. We did the same thing, where we checked whether the Denisovan genome from Denisova Cave matched some humans more than others, and this was a particular interesting finding, when we compared this ancient genome to a Chinese genome and to a New Guinean genome, we found that the Denisovan individual matched New Guineans significantly more often than it did the Chinese. And the only way that this could occur is if there had been Denisovan-related interbreeding into the ancestors of people in New Guinea today, and we estimate that it contributed about 4 to 6% of the ancestry of people in New Guinea on top of the approximately 2% Neanderthal ancestry in this population. So this is an extraordinary finding. Not only is there another ancient bone from another population, but once we have it in hand, it reveals interbreeding events that we didn't know about. If the two times we've discovered archaic humans from DNA, we find two interbreeding events, who's to say that in the third archaic human we find, we might not also discover further interbreeding events? I'm going to skip this slide. But the interbreeding of Denisovans not only occurred with New Guineans, but with the ancestors of Aboriginal people from the Philippines and from Australia. And if you look in these black shaded circles in these pie charts, this is where the Denisovan ancestry is present today. Highest frequency in the Philippines and in Australia and New Guinea, and also in people who have mixed with New Guinean populations as they spread out into the Pacific and into Indonesia. There's also a little bit of such ancestry throughout East Asia. And now we know of many interbreeding events amongst archaic humans and modern humans. I'm not going to go into all of them because each one of these is its own sort of struggle to figure out how it happened and explain. And I wanted to move on to the second part of my talk. And the second part of my talk, sort of another example where it was a great surprise. I came from Luca Cavalli's Sforza school, where we thought we all came out of Africa. There was no interbreeding, and I was very much part of that school. My PhD supervisor was part of the group that established that, and when I came into the consortium, my very strong assumption was that that hadn't occurred. And we, my colleagues and I, worked extremely hard, harder than we otherwise would have, to make the result go away, because we were very skeptical that, of the idea that interbreeding had occurred. But the data seemed to show it in every possible way, and we kept developing new tests, and eventually it's just unambiguous. Right now, there's just so many signals and signs of Neanderthal DNA evident in our genomes, if you're a non-African person, it's just extremely obvious at this point. And so the data forced our hand in that case, even though our assumption was that something different was going on. The question is, how many other ghost populations are there? I think there are hundreds. We already know many others. So, in fact, there are many other cases where, for example, we have predictions of populations not yet found in the ancient DNA. What's clear from looking at genetic data, not just in Europe, but other places that we and others are beginning to get data from, is that people are the results of layers and layers and layers of mixture, that nobody's pure, and that, in fact, those ancestors were not pure either, that, in fact, people are just the results of mixtures and mixtures and mixtures. And the right way to look at this may not be that of a tree, but as a trellis, a kind of just layering and layering of mixing.
So I'd like to make 2 points here before we continue. The first is that I'm very glad to hear him admit he was wrong, as my entire academic career was spent fighting and arguing with professors like him about whether or not humanity was hybridized. In other words, interbred with different hominid species. And before the human genome was sequenced, every professor that I ever spoken to at the time unanimously insisted that it didn't happen, that one type of hominin left Africa and mutated or evolved into the various races without interbreeding, just mutating based on the amount of sunshine and other factors in the environment. Since then, especially during the last decade or so, it's been conclusively proven by DNA sequencing that the various human races came about by different admixture of different hominin species. The dominant contribution that we all share is Cro-Magnon. It was a seafaring race that traveled all around the globe. I guess you could call it similar to colonialism, and it interbred wherever it went. So while Europeans have about 2% Neanderthal and Asians have slightly more, there are also contributions made to people in Southeast Asia of Denisovans, and there will surely be more hominin species announced in the coming years. One example is what geneticists are calling a ghost species found only in the DNA of sub-Saharan Africans, which has not yet been positively identified in the fossil record, but is detected with genetic sequencing. Present-day sub-Saharan Africans trace up to 19% of their genetic ancestry to an extinct archaic hominid species, which is probably Homo erectus or possibly Homo habilis, that is not found in the DNA of present-day Asians or present-day Caucasians or Europeans. These findings also dispel the obsolete myth that sub-Saharan Africans left Africa to populate Europe 35,000 years ago. Since European Cro-Magnon does not contain any genetic contributions from this Homo erectus species. In fact, since sub-Saharan Africans were recently found to have trace amounts of Neanderthal DNA, even though Neanderthal did not live in Africa, it shows the opposite is true, and that European-type Cro-Magnon entered into Africa and created the modern sub-Saharan African races by interbreeding with African erectus. Those that did not understand what I just said Give it another few years for the politically motivated media to catch up. It's hard to understand because it goes against several decades of incorrect indoctrination, but you'll get used to these professors admitting they were wrong. That said, let us listen to the rest of Dr. Reich's presentation, where he talks about the diffusion of the Aryans, which he calls Indo-Europeans, which is the same thing as Aryans, except the term Aryan is a self-designation etched in stone cuneiform thousands of years ago, and Indo-European is not.
Okay, the second thing I wanted to talk to you about was another case where I think a lot of assumptions we had coming into what I had when I grew up about the relationships amongst human populations and the nature of human population structure today are fundamentally wrong. So I think a lot of us have an idea that the population structure we intuitively understand in the world today, people grouped into groups like people like New Guineans or different groups of Africans or, you know, Caucasians or East Asians or South Asians, reflects some kind of age-old population separation that's happened for, you know, eons, right, for a very long time after a bifurcation and spreading from some common ancestral population. But that's profoundly wrong, in fact. In fact, 10,000 years ago, that structure would have been unrecognizable. And I'm going to tell you why that is, because we now know it's that so from ancient DNA. And the example I'm going to give is West Eurasia, which we know best because ancient DNA has been richest from West Eurasia, not because it's a particularly important place in the world, Europe, but because that's where the first ancient DNA studies have been, because scientists who invented this technology were largely in Europe, and that's where we have our best data. But everything that we look at suggests that the same sorts of patterns will be observed in other parts of the world as well. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about a story we published in 2016 where we put together new data from 44 individuals from the ancient Near East. So this is places like Iran and Levant, Jordan and Israel, Anatolia, and the northern part of the Levant, which is, for example, of the Near East, Caucasus, Armenia. So we combine that data with previous data from the steppe north of the Black and Caspian Sea in present-day Russia, and also many samples from Europe that we had data from to try to understand the nature of the human population structure that existed over the last 15,000 years, which was the period over which we were able to interrogate whole genome sequences from this time. And so this picture shows the different places, the Levant, Iran, Anatolia, present-day Turkey, the Caucasus, where Armenia is, and mainland Europe, and the steppe, where each of which we had samples at different points in time. And so the first observation we had, what we did is we took samples that we had at each time slice. So this is on the top is the earliest time slice, about 10,000 years ago. The Near East is a particularly important place in the world because it's where farming was first invented in the world. So farming was first invented about 12 to 11,000 years ago in the Near East, and it spread from each of these invention centers in lots of different directions. So we looked at the data we had from Western Eurasia about 10,000 years ago at the dawn of farming, and we found that the average level of difference between populations is measured by the square of the frequencies differences between populations at that time was 10 times larger than what it is today. And the number on this scale is around 0.1, and that's the level of difference between Europeans and East Asians. So if you look in West Eurasia, there are four different populations at that time, and there was a collapse of that differentiation by about 6,000 years ago to a third of its level, and about by 4,000 years ago to the present-day levels. So somehow something had happened to collapse the population structure in this region that existed 10,000 years ago, which harbored as diversity as different as Europeans and East Asians, to the sameness that you see today. People call these people Caucasians or whites because people sort of approximately look the same and genetically are pretty similar compared to, for example, the difference between Europeans and East Asians. But in fact, this didn't exist 10,000 years ago. These people were not like that. And what you can see from the genetic data is the following. This is what happened. 10,000 years ago, we actually have real genetic data, whole ancient genomes of similar quality to modern genome sequence for medical studies from four populations. Iranian farmers who lived around this time, Levantine farmers who lived in Jordan and Israel, Western hunter-gatherers who lived in the far west of Europe, Eastern hunter-gatherers who lived in the far east of Europe. Each of these groups was as different from each other as Europeans and East Asians are today. And what happened is that none of them disappeared, but they all mixed each with other profoundly. And what you actually see in this region today is mixtures in different proportions of these four source populations with small additional contributions from other groups. But these are the primary sources of ancestry across this vast region. And it's this blurring that creates this relative sense of sameness that we see today. So I wanted, this is a critique of your people's picture of, quote, racial structure today that I think was not really in people's heads before. There are many good critiques of that, but one of them that was not in people's heads was the idea that 10,000 years ago, if you had made such a categorization, it would be completely different from what it is today. So the third thing I wanted to tell you about before I close, and maybe we can have a conversation, is how ancient DNA has yielded a great surprise with regard to an age-old, more than 200-year-old question, which is, how did the languages that we happen to speak in this country come to be? So in 230 years ago, William Jones, a British colonial justice who was serving in present-day Calcutta, in the city of Calcutta, had been trained in his school days in Latin and Greek, and was a polylinguist, was one of these amazing people who knew many languages. He was interested also in the local scriptural languages. And when he studied Sanskrit, he said the following: "The Sanskrit language, whatever may be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and in the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident, so strong indeed that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source which perhaps no longer exists." So this was one of the first articulations of the Indo-European problem. It was not the first, but it was one of the first. And it's the observation that almost all the languages of Europe today, with the exception of Hungarian, Finnish, Estonian, and Basque, and Sami, and as well as Iranian and Northern Indian languages, and Armenian, all stem clearly from the same root. Since that observation, there have been ancient texts in ancient Hittite, which was a language spoken in present-day in ancient Turkey, about 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, which show that that too was an Indo-European language. And there's an ancient language called Tocharian that used to be spoken in the Tarim Basin of China, which was also Indo-European but is now also extinct. So there's been two leading hypotheses to explain this still unsolved mystery of how these languages got to have their distribution today. Note, these languages have hardly been spoken in the Near East for at least the last 5,000 years. We know that because the Near East is where writing was invented about 5,000 years ago, and very few of these languages, except ancient Hittite and a couple of others, are Indo-European. So one of the leading hypotheses is that Indo-European languages spread with the spread of agriculture, which, as I mentioned to you, was developed 11,000 to 12,000 years ago and then exploded out of the Near East after 9,000 years ago, almost simultaneously into Europe from Anatolia and into South Asia from Iran. And the idea is that the people who developed agriculture perhaps were speaking these languages, and it was this mass movement of people enabled by this economic transformation that spread language. We know from anthropological studies that spreads of languages in pre-state societies almost always involve movements of people, and this is the kind of economic transformation that allows much more intense use of land, use that could bring large numbers of new people into a region. The alternative hypothesis was something known as the steppe hypothesis. The steppe hypothesis of Indo-European origins is motivated by a very different observation, and it's motivated mostly by language. So there are many arguments for the steppe hypothesis, but I'll give you one particularly interesting one. In all of these Indo-European languages, with the exception of ancient Hittite, which is the ancient earliest branching of them, there is a common shared vocabulary for axles, wheels, and some vocabulary for horses. And what this suggests is that the common ancestral population knew of these things, knew of wheels, knew of carts. And we know when those were invented because the archaeological record tells us when wheels were invented. Wheels were invented 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, and once they, we don't even know where they were invented, because once they were invented, they spread extremely rapidly because they were obviously extremely useful. So because this happened in the 5,000 to 6,000 years ago, the suggestion is that the spread must have happened no earlier than that, and therefore it cannot be the spread of agriculture, which happened several thousand years before. So that's the step hypothesis. And there's a particular group of people called the Yamnaya. So the Yamnaya are steppe pastoralists who were the first people of the open steppe who used this extraordinary technology of wheels and horses to spread. So prior to the Yamnaya, there were many isolated populations living in the river valleys north of the Black and Caspian Seas. They made different types of pots and stone tools, and each one was different from the other. But after about 5,000 years ago, this Yamnaya group spread and displaced almost all of them. The villages of these groups disappeared. There were almost no more villages. And instead, what you see is great tombs only, with very few villages or no villages, often buried with horses or carts inside of them. And the archaeological interpretation is that these people had learned how to take their supplies out into the open steppe, and they were living an ancient version of mobile homes. They were taking their water out into the steppe, and they were exploiting the vast landscapes that had not been exploited before. These were very rich people, their graves were very rich, and they expanded incredibly. They expanded westward all the way to Europe, to Hungary, eastward all the way to Mongolia, running over lots of groups that had come before. So genetically, we were very interested in trying to understand the population movements that occurred during this critical period. And one of the things, the first ancient DNA from Europe was really focused on the transition from hunting-gathering to farming, which occurred between 8,000 or 9,000 and 8,000 years ago. And the first Europeans, all before 5,000 years ago, in the first ancient DNA samples, were all mixtures of these two types of ancestry, blue, which is the hunter-gatherer type of ancestry, and then after about 8,000 years ago, mostly orange, farmers. And there was none of an ancestry that is ubiquitous today, which is green. So if you look in people today, there's a third ancestry type that wasn't there in Europe 5,000 years ago. So we knew in our laboratory in 2014 that this had to have entered Europe sometime. So in Britain, where we have data, we reported data on 155 individuals from 6,000 to 3,000 years ago, you can measure the proportion of ancestry from first farmers of Britain who arrived in Britain about 6,000 years ago. It took them a couple of thousand years ago to get from Turkey to Britain, and steppe-like ancestry. And when you look at the data, you see that until 4,500 years ago, all the ancestry of everybody, without exception, is first farmer, and then bang, at 4,500 years ago, everybody has about 90% ancestry from the continent. And it's a minimum 90% population replacement. Shortly before 4,500 years ago, the last stones of Stonehenge went up, and these first farmers had built it, and within 100 years, they didn't know that they would be replaced by these people from the continent who very shortly ended the practices that were common at places like Stonehenge. So the implications for Indo-European origins is that it falsifies the single best argument in favor of the Anatolian hypothesis, the idea that it spread with farming. And the best argument was that farming is the only economic transformation that could plausibly enable the large-scale movement of people into Europe. There couldn't have been anything later that was that could have done this, because once a dense farming population was established in Europe, it would be very hard for anybody else to make a dent. Kind of like the British didn't make a dent in India, even though they controlled it for a long time, demographically, because there was just intensively practiced agriculture there already. And yet we know something happened, right? So I don't know how it happened. I don't know what mechanisms allowed these new people to achieve this large-scale replacement, but it did. It clearly did. And it's a 70% replacement in Germany, a 90% replacement in Britain. And now it's up to archaeologists in dialogue with geneticists and anthropologists to figure out what's going on.
So by looking at this linguistics graph, we can identify some of the various terms he used. For example, Hittite, whose empire was in Anatolia, or modern-day Turkey, which is an extinct language now, but probably the first or oldest of the Aryan languages to separate from the original mother tongue. Another is Tocharian, which is here, and belongs to the people who left ancient blonde mummies in western China along the Silk Road, some of them 6 foot 6 inches tall, who populated this region of China before any East Asian phenotypes migrated to the area. And here is the modern Hindi spoken in modern India, and here is Vedic Sanskrit, introduced into India by the Aryans several thousand years ago. Here is the Germanic branch of languages, and German is also descended from the Aryans. And even English that I'm speaking now is an Aryan or Indo-European language that stems from Proto-Indo-European origins, or an Aryan origin. So these languages, as Dr. Reich stated, either spread with agriculture and metals, or with domesticated animals like horses and cattle, or both, by one population, one ethnic group, or one race, if you will. And this demographic happened to have the genetic marker for blue eyes. Geneticists compared mitochondrial DNA from blue-eyed individuals in countries as diverse as Jordan, Denmark, and Turkey, concluding that people with blue eyes have a single common ancestor that lived by the Black Sea around 10,000 years ago, spreading out with agriculture. According to Professor Iberg from the Department of Cellular and Molecular Medicine at the University of Copenhagen, quote, "The first blue-eyed humans were among the Proto-Indo-Europeans, or Aryans, who subsequently spread agriculture into Western Europe and later rode horses into Iran and India." This helps to explain why so many of the statues of ancient Sumerian nobility have blue eyes, and why this color is revered around the ancient Mediterranean, including the many blue-eyed statues of the ancient Egyptian pharaohs and nobility, who, as I said when I started this presentation, were not some small invading force who showed up in recent times, but part of the direct offspring of Cro-Magnon, the fourth root race, whose survivors went on to disseminate agricultural civilization during the entire Holocene, regarded as the teachers in some cultures, or the sun gods in others, from the earliest times, a species with amnesia. My name is Robert Sepper. I'm an anthropologist. My published work is available on Amazon, as well as through various other major book outlets. They make a great gift. If you'd like to support my work, you could do that through patreon.com. There should be a link in the description section for those that are interested. I appreciate it. Thank you. Please hit the like button and subscribe for future updates. As always, I look forward to reading your comments, so please leave me your thoughts below. Please have a wonderful weekend, and I hope to see you again soon.